session number 21560, room 1.
Room 1. Where were you born, please?
In one of the unromantic spot, Ealing, London.
Which year was this?
1919.
Could you tell me a little about where you went to school, please? And grew up?
I went to school at St. Paul's. I grew up in London, roughly in this district, North Kensington.
And what did you do before the war started, please?
I was on the Daily Mail as a cub reporter learning the ropes.
Had you joined any services organisation pre-war?
No.
Did you hear Neville Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
Yes.
Under what circumstances?
I was called up with the first 500, they called them militiamen in the army. The Navy set up a thing called the Royal Naval Special Reserve, and I was called up on August the 16th, and so we were actually, we were called onto the parade ground to hear Chamberlain's speech on September the 3rd.
How did you feel about the news that war had been declared?
Well, I can't remember exactly my feelings. I know that within a very short time the air raid sirens went and we had to go into these very, what struck me as being very shallow dugouts underneath the parade ground. I had been called up to do 6 months a year, and the 6 months turned out to be nearly 7 years.
What was the Special Reserve?
As you know, there was never conscription in peacetime in our forces, and in May 1939 an act was passed which in fact brought in conscription for the first time, and this meant that all 20-year-olds were called up. First of all, they were called up into the army. The Navy, as usual, wanting to be different, decided that they wouldn't call people up until they were 21. And the first lot were to be called up, as I said, in August. I think the first Army men were called up in June. And for reasons which I'm never quite sure about, I was called to an office in Victoria Street, and there I was interviewed by a Commander Rump, RM, who in effect told me that the Navy, that the Army was getting too much publicity, and it was time the Navy got some, and that they intended to call me up with the first 500, although in fact it was a little bit, I wouldn't have been 21, and that they would make me, that they were going to create a thing called the Royal Naval Special Reserve, because obviously men in the Navy couldn't be called militiamen. So they created the Royal Naval Special Reserve, and they said I would be number one if I would write a story about the call up in the Daily Mail. So that's how it happened.
Did you write it?
I wrote it, and I couldn't get to a telephone the same night. It was called Gentlemen of the Navy, because when we first landed in Devonport Barracks, we were given a spiel by a naval officer who started by calling us gentlemen of the Navy. And anyhow, I wrote the story, and next day I couldn't get to a phone. I gave it to our instructor, who was a gunnery, a chief PO, and he said, well, I will have to give it to an officer. I got it back about a fortnight later when it was quite impossible to use, and by that time the war had broken out anyhow, so it was quite irrelevant. So, in fact, it was never used.
What happened after you'd been called to the colours?
I did my preliminary training, square bashing and all the rest of it, in Devonport Barracks. We were then asked which branch of the service we wanted to be in, and I said I wanted to be a stoker in the engine room branch. And I was then sent to Pompey and did my preliminary training as a stoker in what was called the Grammar School in Portsmouth. And that was it. I was then given my first ship, which was the Afridi.
Why did you want to be a stoker?
Oh, for a whole number of reasons, which I've gone into in my book. But principally, I think, because I want to do something completely different. I didn't want to have another desk job. And as far as I knew, it was only going to be 6 months anyhow. So.
Where did you find the Afridi?
Rosyth.
And what impression did the ship make on you at first?
Oh, it was all rather confusing to begin with. I think we sailed the same night, and we had action stations at about 5 o'clock in the morning, which is not used to getting up at that time, and having to load the... I was in an ammunition supply party, and I found the weight of the shells for the 4.7 guns up top extremely heavy, kind of wilted under the weight. Very glad when the rest of it came up, which was lighter. I was then extremely sick for the first 4 days. It was the worst weather in the North Sea for 4 years, and I got extremely sick and very weak.
Did seasickness soon wear off?
After the 4 days, I was all right, and I, for the rest of my experience in the Navy, I found that I was only seasick if I'd been ashore for a long period, you know, up to a week, fortnight, or whatever it was, and then went slap into rough weather. I would then be sick the first day, and then I'd be all right after that.
What kind of duties was Afridi carrying out at first?
We went in pursuit of what we were told then, wrongly, was the Deutschland, which had just sunk the Royal Pindi, Rawalpindi. In fact, it was the Scharnhorst and Neisenauer, which, I don't know when we discovered it, maybe post-war, I forget. But that's what we thought we were going after, the Deutschland. And of course, we didn't come anywhere near it.
And then?
Well, then it was, I suppose, convoy work. We had various, we had one experience of all night long hunting a U-boat and dropping diamonds of depth charges. But we weren't credited with a kill.
So all your early experiences in North Atlantic?
In the North Sea at that time, which is past part of the North Atlantic, yeah. And then, of course, in April, the Norwegian invasion took place, and I was in the Norwegian campaign.
Could you take me through your memories of that step by step in detail, please?
It was a series of crossing over from Scarpa, sometimes from Rosyth, escorting convoys or other duties with the Home Fleet. I remember one case of when it was decided that we would attack Bergen. No, before that. We went, of course, at this stage, this was before the invasion, and Norway was a non-belligerent. There was some slight difference between a non-belligerent and a neutral, but she was non-belligerent, and therefore we weren't supposed to go into Norwegian territorial waters. But I remember that we met up. We had to actually, because of the fog outside, we actually had to go up Bergen Fjord in order to collect the convoy and bring it over. So, in fact, we broke the rules of neutrality there. After the actual invasion on April the 9th, the next thing I remember, I think it was Bergen again, that it was decided to make a frontal attack. As you know, the Germans on April the 9th occupied 6 ports in Norway. And this was obviously against great odds. There were several cruisers in the fjord. I think there were 7 destroyers that were supposed to go up. I forget the actual figures now. Anyhow, Vian himself, Admiral Vian, in his memoirs, said that it was obviously a very risky business. And he was obviously very relieved when this frontal attack was called off. I remember personally going down for the afternoon watch into, I think, number 1 boiler room, and not feeling at all easy. And I think that was the feeling about most of us on board that I know, especially amongst the stokers, that we were obviously going to have a very rough time. We were the Afridi was the first ship actually to go up Namsen Fjord when we were looking for. We went first of all to Ålesund and to Molde, and then Namsen Fjord, looking for a spot where to land the British expedition, the first troops. And the first troops were about 500 Royal Marines and some naval ratings, which were actually landed in Namsos. And that would be about April the 12th. I don't have to go into all the details about what happened to the army. The title of one of the books about it is The Doomed Expedition, and that I think more or less sums it up, mainly because of the impossibility for the Air Force to give us any cover, because they couldn't get over there and get back to base again. So it was a whole succession of raids all the time. And it was finally decided that we would have to pull out. The dates for the evacuation originally were the 1st and 2nd of May. This is 1940, of course. The 30th of April and the 1st of May, and then the 2nd and 3rd. But because of mist and fog, it had to be postponed, the whole program, for a day. The first evacuation took place from Andalsnes, which is south of Trondheim. Originally the idea was to, and the original landings were south and north of Trondheim, with the idea of capturing Trondheim itself. And so when this was abandoned, the troops had to be evacuated from these two spots, from Andalsnes to the south and from Namsos to the north of Trondheim. There was a total of about 12,000 troops which were evacuated, roughly half and half, about 600 odd from Andalsnes, and they managed to get away back to the UK without any losses. Namsos itself had been completely obliterated on April the 20th on the specific orders of Hitler. It was actually on his 51st birthday, though there was no connection between that. I have a copy of the actual order, which said that the civilians, that it was to be, both Andalsnes and Namsos would be knocked out without any regard for the civilians. Andalsnes was bombed, but not quite so, and anyhow it wasn't as quite as large as Namsos. And Namsos, as I say, on April the 20th, in two raids in the morning and the afternoon, was completely obliterated. In fact, today there are supposed to be two residential homes, which are the only remaining houses to have survived.
What do you personally remember of the day of obliteration?
None at all. I wasn't, we weren't there at that stage at all.
You were out at sea?
Yes. Yeah. Then it was, that was April the 20th. Between then and the night of May 2nd and 3rd, there were five ships which were sunk actually in the fjord. Most of them were anti-submarine trawlers, some from Hull, some from Grimsby, or had been. They were supposed to be looking to protect the ships from U-boats getting up the fjord. A number of them were bombed and sunk. I will remind me afterwards, I'll give you another contact of the son and grandson of the CO of the Rutlandshire, which was, and I'll tell you about that story separately. And then there was a sloop, the Bittern, that was sunk. And then that was all just previous to the actual evacuation. The Afridi was the first to come up the fjord on the May the 2nd, although it was the Kelly which actually went alongside the what remained of the jetty. Three French transports managed to, two came alongside and one stood off. And both the French, the Chasseurs Alpins, and the British then started to come on board. And they were taken off, some in the French, most of them in these French transports. We ferried, and the Kelly and the other destroyers, I think the Nubian, ferried them to the transports from the jetty. And the whole idea being, of course, that this had to be, it could only be done after dark, because the Luftwaffe, of course, had been coming over daily during the daylight, daytime. Anyhow, we got them all off, and the Afridi was the last to take off the very last troops, who, in fact, were the rear guard who had been blowing up the bridges across the fjord. And they came on board roughly 2:30 a.m. to 3 o'clock in the morning. By that time, I was on watch down the boiler room. And of course, if you're in the boiler room, you never know exactly what's going on. Everything has to be interpreted according to what you hear. And when we heard firing, our own ship, our own guns firing, we thought that the Germans had already entered Namsos. In fact, we were firing on our own stores and so on, and guns and so on, to destroy them before the Germans came in. So we were the last to leave. I next went on watch 8 o'clock in the morning, by which time we had come out of the fjord. The bombing, and we kind of joined the whole fleet of ships which were evacuating troops. And the bombing started, I think, around about 9 o'clock. The figures given by Chamberlain in the House of Commons were 50 sorties, or 50 bombers, and that was the figure, I think, also given by another source, I think a French source. Other sources gave a very precise figure of 39. I don't know how they arrived at it. But whatever it was, the first kill was on a French destroyer called the Bison, and that was about 10 o'clock. And we went to the aid of the Bison, as well as the two other destroyers, the Grenade and the Imperial. She had had a direct hit on the bridge, and the bomb had gone straight through and exploded in the magazine under the bridge. Everybody, including the commanding officer, was killed. His name was Bouan, B-O-U-A-N. And also our own Navy's liaison officer, who was a commander, he was killed too. She started listing forward, and the crew naturally went aft and started clustering on the stern. The Grenade went alongside. I should say that all these details are not from my own memory, but from the memory of men that I have contacted both on the Grenade and the Imperial and on the Afridi, as well as my own memories. Grenade went alongside and she took off a number of survivors. She also her moiler also picked up men out of the water. I think the Imperial did the same. When we went alongside, it was rather, it was fairly brief, because the depth charges hadn't been neutralized and there was the danger of them blowing up, and therefore it would have obviously been a danger to the Afridi. Anyhow, the raids continued, the bombing continued while the rescue operation was going on. There were rumours which I have not been able to substantiate. I keep on asking, and nobody always, they always say, well, we heard that, but they never said that they themselves saw it. But it was said that the planes which attacked us fired on the Bizon survivors in the water, and it was the tracer bullets which actually set fire to the water. Whether it was that or whether it was the oil fuel ignited anyhow, these wretched men were actually swimming through the oil fuel, which was alight, and they were obviously in a terrible state when we picked them up. And they came up, we brought them up on board. A lot of them went into the galley and the bathroom and so on to try and clean off and so on. A lot of them were very, very badly wounded. There are a whole number of other details which I got from French sources as well as our own sources. Very interesting details. As you know, of course, wrecks can't be allowed to remain afloat because they're a danger to shipping, and therefore, after the Imperial and the Grenade had left in order to rejoin the convoy, which of course had carried on, it was decided that we should sink what was left of the Bisson, which at this time was settling quite a lot at forward, and it was tilting up, the stern was tilting up quite a bit. But there were already There were still quite a number of survivors still clinging to the stern. Our number one, who I discovered afterwards, was a French interpreter also. He shouted through loudspeakers to the men to jump into the water so that we could pick them up. But there still remained this nucleus of survivors on the stern, even when, first of all, we fired, I think, two tin fish, which missed completely. We then had to open fire with the 4.7s. And round after round, of course, went into her until she sank with these men still on board. It's interesting that Vian, in his memoirs, doesn't mention this aspect of it. He merely says that she was sunk and that we quickly rejoined and so on. We, after that, the Bisson was sunk. We then rejoined the convoy, and I suppose it was about 1:45 when we rejoined. I, at that time, was extremely lucky. Up to then, I had been doing my watch in the boiler room in number one boiler room. We had three boilers. About a week before this, we had a new chief stoker who joined, who completely changed the rotor. And I was then given the